Mr. Schnell, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
How much?
At least 2 minutes.
I will try to remind you, but ultimately it is your responsibility.
Yes, sir, I understand.
You may have heard me say that before. You may begin, Lynette.
May it please the court, I am Matthew Snow.
Can I start off with a couple quick questions?
Yes, sir.
To try to crystallize the issue. The jury saw the videotape.
Yes, sir.
And the jury read the affidavit.
Yes, sir.
And the judge instructed the jury on the elements of the crime of perjury. Isn't that a question of fact for the jury to determine whether those elements were met?
Ultimately, it is a question of fact for the jury to assess.
And there was really, with respect to that issue, no testimony because you had the affidavit and you had the videotape. So it was a question of fact that was determined adversely to your client. What's the error there that this court can review?
When you look at a jury's...
I'm setting aside the authentication question.
Yeah, right. So I think that the easiest way to say it is mental state.
I'm sorry?
Mental state of the defendant in this case.
But isn't that always going to be a question of fact?
It is going to be a question of fact. What I would suggest to the court is that in this situation, although it's certainly entitled to view the evidence, view the video, make its determination, what it can't do is ignore wholly undisputed facts. And there are wholly undisputed facts here which question the ability for the jury to be able to make a beyond a reasonable doubt decision related to the mental state with regard to the belief that the statement was false.
Is it a good defense? You say the mental state of your client.
Yes.
Is it a good defense to perjury? Say, well, gee, I believe that to be true. Is that a good defense?
Well, it's a fundamental element of the statute. 18.2-434 specifically states the mental state must be a willful statement at the time it was made. So therefore, it doesn't really matter whether the statement, in the end, whether it was correct or incorrect.
What evidence was there before the court that your client did not mean what was contained in the affidavit, or that he believed it to be true?
I think when you look at the undisputed facts of the case, it's a matter of he believed it to be true. So if you look at the undisputed facts, the fact that in the 2 weeks that intervened from the event that happened and when his statement was actually made, he made at least 3 separate written requests to preserve the video. Now, this whole case centered around the video, right? The video was played multiple times for the jury. Uh-huh. Everybody looked at it and was able to draw their interpretations. But if you look at the undisputed fact that over a 2-week period of time, an inmate who has never seen the video is saying over and over and over again, preserve the video, preserve the video, preserve the video. And yet
it might have been a mistake.
Well, at the end, that was clearly the evidence that the Commonwealth used to contradict his statements. But that action, the repeated behavior, the repeated written requests are actually evidence of his mental state.
Did you argue that to the jury?
It was argued to the jury, Your Honor.
And we know what the jury thought of it.
We know what the jury thought of it.
Let's move on to authentication. Your client testified at trial, correct?
He did.
Did he ever testify, hey, what's in this affidavit, that's not really my affidavit?
No, he never said that.
Didn't he testify that, again, testify as to exactly what was in the affidavit?
Yes, sir.
And then he had an affidavit, it was presented to the magistrate. What was wrong with the authentication here?
Well, the authentication, my focus and my suggestion to the court is that you have to look at the decision made by the trial court at the time that that evidence was initially admitted.
Yes.
Okay. So the authentication statements made by the deputy who sought to authenticate them included his statements that, let me make sure I get it correct here. I didn't take a direct look at it. It was in his possession and he presented to the magistrate, so I really had no direct contact with it. So with regard to the issue...
So what?
Well, because the issue of authentication goes to the issue of establishing that it's a genuine document. So at the time that that document was admitted, There has to be at least sufficient evidence, whether it's direct or circumstantial or otherwise, to show it's a genuine document that it's actually personal knowledge of the person.
What is the standard? What is the standard for the authentication of a document?
No writing may be admitted into evidence unless and until it has been authenticated, i.e. it has been shown to be genuine. Proctor versus Cumwell, 14, Virginia Court of Appeals, 937.
Okay. Well, what about this? The amount of evidence sufficient to establish authenticity will vary according to the type of writing and the circumstances attending its admission.
Yes.
But generally, proof that any circumstances will support a finding that the writing is genuine will suffice.
Yes.
In this case, don't we have... You know there's an affidavit. And your client testifies at trial as to exactly what's in the affidavit.
Yes, sir.
How, if it's not his affidavit, how could he testify as to its contents?
Well, I think that specific issue in terms of his testimony that he later offered goes to the issue really, and I'm saying something different with the court is, but whether he waived the issue of the admission of that document or the objection that was made there because he essentially then later authenticated it. But I think the issue for review is whether or not at the time that the document was admitted, whether the court made that. So referring to what the defendant...
Why don't the statements of Lieutenant Snell and Lieutenant Richardson get them over the admissibility hurdle? Now, there's plenty of room to attack them. Well, you're not certain, you're not positive, but why doesn't that go to weight and not admissibility? Because Snell testified he believed the document to be the statement that was given to the magistrate, and Richardson testified without objection that he presumed it to be. So his statement that he presumes it is the statement is in front of the trier of fact. That's evidence in the case.
Because in and of itself, those statements establish they have no personal knowledge. If you're presuming something, you're by definition basically saying you don't really have the personal knowledge. You're making an assumption. With regard to Lieutenant Snell, he specifically said, I didn't get a direct look at it. He's establishing that he doesn't really know what the document is. He's also making an assumption or presumption. Both of those statements clearly establish neither one of them actually had personal knowledge related to the document.
But so what if the people who took him over to the magistrate said, yeah, I didn't look at it. So what?
Well, then, at that point, if they have no personal knowledge, they cannot verify or support, or the evidence that they put on was insufficient to establish that it's a genuine document. So at the time it's admitted, the court doesn't have any evidence before it to support the idea that it's been authenticated or established that it's actually a genuine document.
Thanks.
That's the focus of argument. I'm going to go back, if I can, to the issue of that the intent, what I call the willfulness of the statement, because I think, quite frankly, that's really the strongest issue to present before this court.
Obviously, if he just says, I didn't intend, I believed what I said, if that's his testimony, I believed what I said, the jury's free to reject that and just go, we saw the video now. So I guess you're arguing that there's this pre-testimony, preserve the videotape, that the jury can only conclude he thought the tape helped him.
I think that's the only logical conclusion you can draw. I mean, the jury is certainly allowed to infer things, right, from facts.
Do people always behave logically?
Certainly not. But that's not the only undisputed fact that I would point to. Besides the fact that he made those multiple requests to preserve the video, we have the fact that he actually conducts a reenactment. That's one of the evidence, pieces of evidence that was presented. So 2 weeks after this incident happens, before he goes to the magistrate, when he's interviewed by Lieutenant Richardson, he actually does a reenactment of the incident, the full thing. And he's doing it solely based on memory. He hasn't been shown the cell block video, solely based on memory. It's videoed on a cell phone by one of the other deputies who was there. And his reenactment matches up with the ultimate statement that he presented in his criminal complaint before the magistrate. That's another undisputed fact, because he was never challenged.
Well, if you're going to be charged with perjury, and you're asked to reenact or decide to reenact what happened, wouldn't you have it match what your statement was?
But
I mean, since the reenactment occurs after the sworn statement.
Sure, and then you got to match it up with all of these other pieces, and now I'm going to refer back to the fact that he's making those requests for the cell block video over and over again. And even in that interview with Lieutenant Richardson, he actually asked Lieutenant Richardson to get the cell block video. He didn't even know at that point Lieutenant Richardson had already viewed the cell block video. Now, Lieutenant Richardson never challenged him, never gave him any indication that he had seen it or he disagreed or anything. So at the time that Mr. Anderson is making these statements to the magistrate later on, 2 weeks have gone by. He's made requests for the video. He's performed his own reenactment. There's been no indication over those 2 weeks from that, you know, short-lived event that's solely now preserved in his own memory for all of these statements.
Do you think the jury considered the fact that he told this guard, I'm going to have your child?
That was evidence presented by the Commonwealth. And that's certainly something that the jury could have considered. I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that while the jury can consider and throw out basically the defendant's testimony, while it can look at this, at the video, it can't ignore the undisputed facts, which logically don't match up with the conclusion that it reached.
Could a reasonable juror go, the reason he's asking for the videotape is if it disappears, he's got an out, or to claim that he didn't, what appears on the videotape isn't how he perceived it. I mean, to make the argument, the very argument that you're making now and that you made to the jury, if it could a juror, based on the evidence, conclude that that was part of his scheme to avoid liability in much the way you're arguing? And I'm not saying that every juror would conclude that. I'm not saying that I would conclude that. The question is, could any juror conclude that?
I think for any juror to conclude that, it's a non sequitur. You are now restructuring certain undisputed facts in a new way or in a new light in a way that doesn't follow along logically or with the evidence. So in that situation, I think a juror is actually going outside the bounds of a logical interpretation in order to justify their own view or conclusion on that fact. And that's really what the issue is coming down to for this argument, is at the case, everything focused on what happened. Was it correct? Was it incorrect? There was almost no evidence whatsoever related to the belief of the defendant at the time that he made the statement. And even if you throw out his testimony and disregard it because it's self-serving testimony from the defendant, the jury was plainly wrong in ignoring those key undisputed facts of what happened and what led up to these 2 weeks, that just they don't go with the idea that this was something he believed to be false. Another way of looking at it is it actually reinforced the fact that he believed it to be true.
Do you think if you put on an expert witness who testified to the effect, well, Mr. Anderson is delusional, and despite what the affidavit says, I mean, despite what the videotape shows, he really thought what he wrote in the affidavit was true. And was that argument made to the jury, that specific argument?
The expert witness and the delusional?
Yeah, I mean, but
I don't think that specific argument was made.
Did you argue the jury, well, he's delusional. He believed this, but he's half nuts.
I don't know if that's, I don't recall that specific argument being made. What was argued to the jury that I recall, Your Honor, and I haven't reviewed that part of the record, was the fact that it's what he believed to be true. And in his own mind, he's, you know, the jury can look at those past 2 weeks where he's in that cell.
But he's obviously delusional if he believes that.
Okay.
In light of the videotape.
And if he's delusional, then he's innocent. He's not guilty. Because the issue is, unless he knows that statement to be false at the time he makes it, that's not perjury. That's just being wrong.
You can use it any way you want to, but you're into your rebuttal time.
Okay. No reserve. Thank you.
Again.
May it please the Court, Your Honor, Stephen Forster on behalf of the Commonwealth. Good morning. To start, to take counsel's argument to its logical conclusion, any defendant who gets on the stand and says, I believe X, regardless of what the evidence shows, would potentially be precluded from being convicted of perjury.
Well, I think he concedes that the jury would be free to disregard such a self-serving statement.
Agreed, Your Honor. That was my second point. It would subvert the role of the jury as being fact-finder.
Well, I think he concedes that. He just says when you have it uncontroverted that he was doing these things before he testified, that you can't disregard that the way you could just disregard him saying, I believed what I wrote. And so what's your response to that?
Understood, Your Honor. My response to that is we look at all of the circumstances, and even leading up to this, and we're calling it uncontroverted evidence, but it's not really the case here. We have the testimony of Officer Weeks, who was involved in the incident, testified to the contrary, which the jury heard. We have a video showing contrary to what the defendant swore to in his affidavit, swore to before the magistrate, what he testified to as well. So it's not uncontroverted evidence. The few components of what the counsel's talking about are, yes, he wanted the videotape secured. Yes, he wanted to file a criminal complaint. But obviously, he also made the comment, I'm going to have your job. He was proceeding. He wanted to file an assault charge. He was looking to support his theory. Again, however, that doesn't go to the components of whether or not the three elements of perjury, which are false statement under oath, did so willfully in a statement that touched a material thing. And it's essentially three elements plus corroboration. And here the jury was free to disregard his testimony, take the testimony of the officers as well as the video, and conclude that all the elements plus corroboration were met. Everything, the evidence was sufficient to sustain the conviction for perjury. You know, we go through the testimony, look at Deputy Weeks, I touched him with two fingers, and I didn't slam the door on his arm, I removed my arm immediately. He testifies to that. We have Sergeant Anderson testifying as to, I reviewed the tapes, I did a full thorough investigation, and I don't see what he's talking about. I'm not going to give him a criminal complaint because I don't see any of the allegations being confirmed.
Do you attach any significance to his request, repeated request, to save the videotapes?
No, I do not attach anything to that. Again, in light of what the videotapes showed, his belief that it was going to help his case, I don't know. The significance of it, perhaps it goes to the belief component, but again, I would note that the
whatever significance should be attached to it was in front of the jury and they made a determination.
Exactly, Ron. All the evidence was put before the jury, and whatever significance he attached to it, the jury disregarded his testimony and found that the evidence was sufficient, that there was what he was saying was completely contradicted by what they viewed. And even if the jury disregarded the testimony of the Deputy Weeks and Officer Anderson, they were comparing what he testified to in his affidavit to the video. And they were free to make the determination that there was no way he could possibly believe that what he was saying and what he was putting before the court was actually true. And again, to say that just because he believed it did a few things would subvert the role of the jury in making that determination. Now I'm going to the argument with respect to authentication. With respect to Exhibit 3, as Judge Haley pointed out, all that's required is circumstantial proof. Besides the Williams versus Commonwealth case on brief, it's a proof of any circumstance which will support a finding that the writing is genuine. In this particular instance, we have Deputy Weeks testifying. I picked him up from his cell. He had a piece of paper. I transported him to the magistrate. He had the same piece of paper. I watched him present that document to the magistrate, and it looked like the document that I saw in his hand. We had Sergeant Anderson testifying to, I was presented with a copy of that document, and Exhibit 3 was the affidavit presented.
You'll concede the Commonwealth could have done a better job of authenticating.
Yes, Your Honor. I wouldn't say this is the case study for authentication. However, it's a very low threshold. It's a very low burden. It's any circumstance that will suffice to show it's genuine. Deputy Weeks didn't need to become in direct contact and review it and know what language was in it. That's not required. Direct contact is not the standard by which authentication is governed. And for that reason, again, I think Deputy Weeks' testimony combined with Anderson's testimony was more than sufficient to authenticate the document. And then we also have the defendant's testimony, which was to the contents of the document. We'll briefly go into harmless error, even if the document were admitted without being properly authenticated. Again, the defendant testified as to the contents of the document. Detective Anderson,
What about the argument that he would have elected not to take the stand if the affidavit hadn't come in?
I'm not sure to have an answer to that. I would just say that his choice to take the stand was his, and he made that decision. I'm not certain that argument was made below, and I'm not certain as to what he would have done. It would be speculative at best, but at this point we're looking at it from a harmless error perspective. And he took the stand, he testified to it, and even if he didn't, I still think we have sufficient proof through Sergeant Anderson as to what he testified happened, as to his reenactment. We know what he was saying was happening. He described the interaction in quite great detail, viciously attacked, grabbed my arm, slammed my arm, and that came through the testimony of the other witnesses. So I would submit to the court that any error would have been harmless. If there are any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I will rely on my brief.
Thank you, counsel.
Can I ask one quick question?
Yes, sir.
Was the jury given an instruction along these lines? If you find as a fact that the defendant believed what he put in his affidavit to be true, then you shall find him not guilty. I mean, that's your argument.
It is. At this exact moment, I can't tell the court whether that specific instruction was given. I know there were instructions related to that, but I don't know if that specific phrasing was in any of the instructions.
Thank you.
The only thing I want to point out in response to the Commonwealth's argument is there's a lot of focus on what did happen or what didn't happen, the correctness. They're going back to, you know, Deputy Weeks, who was the one involved in the incident, testified this, and that was different from the defendant. The issue going to my point about the undisputed facts has to focus with those facts which were not challenged, which corroborate and point to the issue of his belief. Because there was no other evidence on the issue of his mental state.
Well, except, isn't a jury always free to go that you intend the natural and probable consequences of your action, and therefore he knew what had happened, and his version is just false, and he just decided to lie, and then he just consistently lied about it the entire time through everything, through the reenactment.
I understand that. I think that the problem with that is if you intend the probable and natural consequences of your action, why would he repeatedly request the very video that was used to try and contradict his statement unless he believed it to be true?
I do have one additional question.
Yes, sir.
If we conclude that with the affidavit and evidence, the evidence was sufficient to support the conviction, but we conclude that the affidavit should not have been admitted into evidence, all you're entitled to is a remand, and then they could take additional steps to authenticate the affidavit. Is that correct?
I agree with that.
All right. Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel.